The churches on the East Coast are Protestant rather than Catholic. There's a lot of, well, the first kind of the predominant group in Nicaragua would be the Moravians. Yeah. And then our Anglicans, our Episcopalians, and then would come the Roman Catholic Church. So that's kind of the setup there. And the conflict always comes again, particularly in the Roman Catholic Church, between a very conservative hierarchy. Right? The Vatican and the Pope are very conservative and kind of anti-liberation theology. Mm-hmm. And priests and people are much more liberation theology. So there's this internal struggle going on for kind of who speaks for the church and how is the church going to minister to the people. Is it going to be involved in society and politics, working for justice, even being involved in some of these projects? Some people in the church are trying to set up, again, universities and vocational schools, so that the knowledge that, you know, like the Danish government and others bring in, right, can be taught, and these people can learn it, so they get out of that dependency cycle. But again, the Nicaraguan government and the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church wants everything to happen over on the west side, over in Managua. And right again, the power struggle there, and basically seeing the East Coast and the indigenous peoples as kind of second class citizens. Mm-hmm. So there's that kind of struggle going on for even the for what they're calling the autonomy of the eastern region. It's a lot like, I don't know how much you follow some of the news, or even how much it gets here. It's a lot like in Canada, where Quebec is trying to have its autonomy and sovereignty from the rest of Canada. That's what's happening in Nicaragua. The Atlantic coast and the English-speaking and indigenous people want to have their autonomy from the rest of Nicaragua. Not so much to have two separate countries, but to not just simply have to follow the dictates of the West, and have all their money and everything flow away from their area.
Well, that's just in-state colonialism.
Yeah.
Well, how are they doing that?
Well, there have been certain commissions set up now to investigate these kinds of things and to look into the autonomy. And interestingly, in the East, the two people that are to head those commissions, one is a Moravian minister and the other one is an Anglican minister. So you can see again the church is very much involved in that. But the Managua government, the central government, has really been dragging its feet. And because they don't want that autonomy to happen, it probably will happen eventually, it looks like. And so what they're trying to do is get as much out of the region as they can. Like right now, the government again is giving great grants to its friends and other industries so that they have all the mineral rights and fishing rights and everything like that. And people on the East Coast don't get it. There's a lot of as often happens in these countries, graft and corruption going on. That all the fish that are taken out of the waters, you have to have a license to fish in Nicaraguan waters, but it just so happens that folks who are in the government in Managua buy all these licenses and then sell them for 7, 8, 10 times as much to other people to fish the water. So that's how they get their kickback. And then often what they do is these people who buy these licenses, even at the high price, they buy one license for a boat, and they may call the boat Lady Two, but there are 6 Lady Twos out there. So in other words, they give 6 or 7 boats the same name, and they all fish under that same license. And so that's one of the ways that, right, and nobody on the East Coast gets the resources. Now again, it's the churches that have been involved in trying to set up investigative committees to try to look into these things to see if they can change it, so on. But it takes a lot of time. They've appealed to the United Nations about that.
Anything like that that comes up over about making your daily living is a real demand on an individual, on a family. Mm-hmm. And those are big issues. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have the resources to form co-ops, unions, clubs, whatever you call it, to,
yeah,
to where you can have people represent you, you're really handicapped. Mm-hmm. Which poor people don't have in place.
That's right. That's right. So that again, one of the things that the church does is, and they have the slogan, just it's just that easy. They go around telling people, you know, get organized, mm-hmm. and trying to help people in simple ways of getting organized or of setting up cooperatives, right? Very basic, simple cooperatives. But that's hard because, I mean, like you say, most of these folks spend their whole day in just subsistence living. The economies down there are so bad that it takes all that a family can do together just to make enough to eat and a little clothing, and that's about all they have. Some makeshift shelters. So they're trying very much to get organized, but it doesn't take much from a group that is organized to make that possibility for others very difficult. All sorts of rules, red tape.
Even a few rules, because if you're familiar with them, maybe other people are not.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the things they're trying to do on the East Coast is they want to make English and Miskito and Sumo, which are again the indigenous groups, in the official languages, so that the people can, right, understand the rules, or if they have to go to court. Right, that they can at least go to court and argue in their own language, present their case in their own language. Because again, usually the thing is, they have to fly over to the West Coast or if you go by boat and bus. I mean, there isn't even a road from Managua all the way to the East Coast. It's They just don't even have that yet in their infrastructure. So you either fly or basically have to go by boat and then by bus. Right? You get over to Managua where all the courts are and everything goes on in Spanish and they don't know what's happening to them. Right? They just sit there and all these people are talking away and then all of a sudden a decision comes down and they find out they have to give up their land or they didn't get what they were asking and they don't know why. And so one of the first things they're trying to do is make English and the two major indigenous languages, legal languages. And that's one of the big issues in the legislature right now. And again, the churches, even this one, even the Catholic Church is supporting this one and saying that that's something that should be done.
Basic justice.
Yeah, very, at that level, just very basic justice. Mm-hmm. The other thing, again, is still issues of human rights and just the enforcement of the United Nations Code on Human Rights that... Nicaragua is probably one of the better countries in Central America in terms of honoring human rights, but there's still some violations going on. There's still people who are arrested without being told what the charges are against them and things like that. So that too is still one of the things that people are trying to correct. The United Nations observer teams are still there. They're getting ready again for the elections in 1996. And so that'll be a challenge to see what's going on. Again, often the church functions as observers or gets people to come in as observers at the time of the elections. That becomes very important. But it's still, the concern is, again, can they have democratic elections when the more powerful and conservative parts of the society have all this outside money? Either they get it kind of sneakily from the U.S. government in different ways and grants, or there's from folks that fled Nicaragua after the revolution and were basically Somoza's relatives or well-known friends of Somoza, and that most of them went to Miami and live in Miami or in that area. And they're still trying to get their people back into office again down in Nicaragua. And so they send down huge amounts of money. Last year there was the election for the mayor of Managua. And he was, again, a friend of Somoza's and all of that. And people figured, well, he wouldn't win the election or anything. But he won it overwhelmingly, and probably the major reason for that is he had over $1 million contributed from all the ex-Somoza supporters in the States, and primarily out of Miami. And so again, people in the church are asking, how fair can elections be when one side or one group gets such a tremendous amount of money and help from the outside, and the other group, which tries to gain its support from its own people in the country, doesn't come anywhere near to that kind of money. You know, are those elections fair? I mean, in the sense, that's right, nobody is stuffing ballot boxes or anything like that. But are those elections fair when there's such an unfair advantage that one person right, can be on the radio and television and have posters all over the place all the time, and the other candidates just can't afford that. So the church is trying to set up and make suggestions for ways in which to conduct fair and honest elections. Do you hear much about Central America over in Denmark? Is that?
Yeah, I haven't lived in Denmark for half my life, so.
Oh.
I don't know. I have a feeling that they probably do. If there's a country in Central America that Denmark especially would support with fishing or with development, then there would be quite a bit of news about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that the just kind of in general the Scandinavian countries have taken a real interest in Central America for some to help them with their development. Norway, like I said, Norway, Sweden, Denmark have projects going on in just about every one of the Central American countries. Mm-hmm. Nicaragua is their primary target, but they're also doing things in El Salvador and in Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras. So it...
Well, they probably were able to get into Nicaragua early on. Before the last election,
yeah, that's right. I mean where the United States, right, was not at all open to the Sandinistas, right? Well, with Reagan and all of the Contra war and all of that, tried to see them fall. The Scandinavian countries were always willing to support Nicaragua, recognize the Sandinista government as the official government, and maintain relationships, diplomatic relations with Nicaragua, whereas a lot of countries didn't, but the Scandinavian countries did, and so their embassies were also very important places, again, for economic aid, technical aid, human rights centers. So they worked a lot on that. Yeah. I hear Medardo Gomez, the bishop, the Lutheran bishop from El Salvador, is what, coming in?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow, okay. And is he going to be here all week?
I think so. I don't know, but we talked about this already at the end of the winter that he would come. And I thought it was said that he'd be here a week, but I don't know. But I did hear that it should be tomorrow that he's coming. But then again, somebody said, we usually have celebrating here Christmas in July. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, well, it happens to be on a Sunday, and it's the day Bishop Gomez comes in, but see, that the 25th is on Monday, so we may have got some dates a little mixed up there, so he may not come till Monday. Mm-hmm. We're not going to celebrate Christmas in July this year.
We're not?
No.
Oh my, that's a big change. I think they've always done Christmas in July.
They've done it for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it will be interesting to have Gomez up here and hear what he has to say about El Salvador now after the elections.
Yeah, because it's some months now, so there should be sort of a trend.
Yeah, because the first elections were there in March, and then the runoff elections were a month later in May. So.
Pastor Oines was there as an observer.
As an observer. Yeah, so you've probably heard. Yeah, I think many people were very much surprised that Arena, the conservative party again, and was elected. But I think what happened is that the other side, that used to be the FSLN, or FMLN, that the FMLN just fragmented. All the groups that had kind of worked together in opposition to the government and military for the previous 10 years, once the ceasefire was signed and they had a peace accord, then they all fragmented and all went their own way, and none of them could even get close to a majority on anything in any area, and so they just all lost out. Which is, again, something different than what happened in Nicaragua, right, where the FSLN, where they were different groups, but they still stayed together and kind of, you know, that first time rallied behind Daniel Ortega. And in the second election in 1990, he wasn't elected, but it was still close enough that there's still a significant opposition in the Legislative Assembly. I mean, it's when we were down there again, a poll was taken, and right, if the elections were to be held tomorrow or something like that, it would be just about 50-50 in terms of the popularity of the Sandinistas, popularity of some other kind of candidate. And the issues, still the basic issue is that the people of Nicaragua are still so afraid that if they elect somebody that the United States doesn't like, and that means that if they elect somebody who is seen as a Sandinista, that the U.S. is going to start the war all over again.
Yeah, fear is a very powerful thing.
And that's, yeah. Well, for the last election in 90, when you would ask people, even now today, you still ask them, why didn't you vote for Daniel Ortega? And their reason was, because Violeta Chamorro said that if she were elected, right, she could end the war, that the United States would end the war. And, you know, the U.S. made that loud and clear, too, that if, you know, the Sandinistas are defeated, the Contra war would end. And so, by and large, most people, and you can understand that, most people voted not because they didn't like Ortega, but because they wanted the war to end. You know, he'll do a lot of things not to have to live in conditions of war. And so that's what happened. But that fear is still there. And
when will they have that next election?
1996.
Six years.
Six years between. Yeah, and Ortega won't run. Daniel Ortega won't run. He has said that already, just to make kind of to give that signal to the United States, right? Because he knows that people in the U.S. still think, or at least the U.S. government, some within the U.S. government still think that he's just quote unquote a communist. So he knows that the Sandinistas won't win if he's the candidate, just because of the fear factor. So he says he's out. No clear leading candidate has been found yet, so it'll be interesting to see who they run. And the current president, Violeta Chamorro, has also said that she won't run again.
Four long years for her, because
yeah.
She when an election comes out like that, there's really not a mandate to.
No.
Nothing to back up any decisions, any programs you want to push.
No, that's right. I mean, it was very clear that she was elected because the Contra war would end, and it did. Right. I mean, so that's. But in terms of economics, in terms of any policy in the country, she hasn't been able to get anything accomplished. Or if she has tried to get something accomplished, there are other people, the more conservatives in the coalition that she was in, that basically block every move she tries to make. So she's kind of a figurehead. She's well respected and loved by the people. I mean, they consider her to be a kind and compassionate woman. But they all know as well she's an ineffective leader. So it makes for a very interesting situation. And again, it looks like one of the key people who probably will run is the mayor of Managua, who is this close friend to Somoza. And he has a lot of money behind him. Conservative, wealthy Nicaraguan money, and also Cuban money, interestingly enough. Yeah, the conservative Cuban community that left Cuba when Castro took over. They're in support because somehow, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but the thinking of the community is to think that somehow if a government in Nicaragua gets in that would be friendly to Castro, then Castro again would have help and an ally and somebody to help him out of his problems in Cuba. And so there's still in Central America this funny kind of Cold War mentality going on among the military and conservative people, often again the business people, the landowners, that they still see that somehow Castro has all this power and he's able to pass on revolutions to all the different places within Central America and Latin America. So we always have to be very careful and work very hard at stopping Castro. All sorts of, kind of rumors continue to abound about that kind of stuff, or other rumors. I mean, to go to Guatemala for a moment, one of the big rumors that's been going on in Guatemala for at least the last 6 months is the rumor that you need to be careful about U.S. people that come down to Guatemala because they will kidnap and sell your children on the black market, adoption market.
I think our business manager felt a little like that. Of that, she was down there for Easter, and yeah, something had just happened just then. Mm-hmm. She hasn't had much time to tell us anything about it because she's probably not. Her mother died.
Oh, I didn't hear that her mother. Oh, gee.
Her mother died. She got a message at 2 this morning.
Huh.
So she and her husband left, and they only had a week. They only have a week left here anyway, and she has been so much out of the village because of her mother and because of business engagement and a trip that she had planned to Hungary for some World's Women's Organization. That's what we will see slides on this evening.
This evening.
That we haven't had a lot of contact with her for a long time.
For a long time, yeah.
But I did hear that it was not easy to go down there and be a guest just before Easter.
Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't. And they were, there were stories of, in some of the smaller rural areas, in that if an American would be out there, kind of the people in the village would almost surround them, and, you know, had to be careful. And even when we were down here, this was just the end of June, they told us to be very careful. I mean, usually, again, right, Americans, they always go around, you know, they've got their cameras with them. They like little kids, right? So often if you see a little kid, they'll, you know, pat them on the head or start talking with them or take their picture. And we were told, you know, one, don't touch the children, right? Don't make the first move toward any child, because that will be very suspicious. And even two, don't take their picture unless you ask their parents' permission first. Because again, they felt if you were going around kind of right, touching, playing with kids, taking their pictures, they would be suspicious and still think that you were looking them over to see if this is one of the kids you would want to sell for adoption. So it's just crazy. I don't know who started it. I mean, everybody's blaming everybody else for starting the rumor, right? They're now saying it's a rumor and not true, although there was. I think this came out about Easter time too. One of the Supreme Court justices in the Guatemalan government was convicted of black marketing in adoption with children. So there was somewhat of this kind of black market going on, but I mean very small scale, and interestingly enough, government people were involved in it, not particularly Americans or anything like that, but most people tend to think that it was the military that started it, because the military doesn't like internationals, and particularly people from the United States, kind of going down there, you know, just being there looking around, because, then the military doesn't have the free rein to do what they want to do. And so they would prefer to get all internationals out of the country, right? And so, and particularly Americans. But now they've run into conflict with the business community, because what the business community would like to do is really up the tourism industry. So obviously, right, it's not good for tourism if your people want to, you know, kind of surround Americans and lynch them in the streets, right? So they're the ones now that are trying to push, you know, this is a rumor, this is not true, your children are safe wherever Americans are, and so on and so forth. And so they're trying to put the rumor down. So it's not as tense as it used to be, but still have
those
to be
those things
careful.
Take a while to change, because yep. I mean, once that word gets to America, it's easy to choose a different travel destination.
Yeah.
And also for Europeans.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, that's precisely what happened, right? The State Department issued a kind of like traveler's warning or traveler's advisory to Americans, telling them that they shouldn't go to Guatemala. Mm-hmm. It wasn't safe. And so now the Guatemalan government is up in Washington lobbying very hard to get the State Department to kind of lift that warning.
Oh, so they haven't lifted it yet?
No, they haven't lifted it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And And they would prefer that U.S. citizens don't go to Guatemala. But that...
complicated.
That may change, yeah. Again, what happened the last week in June is that as they're trying to get the peace accord in Guatemala, they made a significant step the last week in June over in Oslo, Norway. The two sides agreed to establishing a truth commission to find out, violations of human rights, who was doing it, bringing them to trial, and things like that. And obviously the U.S. was very pleased that that was happening. And so they're going to do that. I know, we're a full crowd here.
That's for, you're doing Bible study, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
What's the schedule for that? 7:45
and 9.
So when it says time here, should I put down 9 o'clock for taping?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. What day do I have off?
Thursday.
It's always Thursday.
It's always Thursday because that's when we do tech study. I didn't mean to interrupt your conversation.
That's okay. I'll get it to you soon.
Good. I don't think we're going to work on it till the morning.
Okay. Have you been down to Central America or Latin America at all?
I could wish that our children would take a bigger interest in learning Spanish. There's such a big influx of people coming over the border, and a lot of Spanish people came here already.
Yeah.
English is already my foreign language. I wish they would have that as a foreign language. I think it's important when you live here.
Mm-hmm. Where do you live now? I mean,
we live here.
Yeah, I know you're at Holden, but when you're not at Holden.
Well, we've been here 3 years.
3 years.
So we really are here.
So you are here.
We came from Idaho.
From Idaho.
Yeah. There's a lot of Hispanic people in Idaho.
Yeah.
And I have worked on farms years ago where part of the crew only speak Spanish. Even my boss didn't speak Spanish, so it's not easy. You don't have full communication.
Yeah. Yeah, well, again, even from down in Central America, as they look back at the U.S. and immigration patterns of people moving up and things like that. They say in places like San Diego and Los Angeles, the Hispanic community will soon be the majority. And that there will be more Spanish-speaking people than English-speaking people in those parts of the states. And, because of the war in Guatemala, the second largest concentration of Guatemalans outside of Guatemala City is Los Angeles. So there are just huge amounts of Spanish-speaking people in the Southwest, and of course Miami and that area, Florida,
yeah,
is primarily Spanish-speaking. Dade County, where Miami is in, is already majority Spanish.
So. This is changing the subject. What about the people in those areas and the official language that they can go to court with?
You mean like
in this country? In those areas where there are so many.
Yeah, well, I know that it's it's split. There are some groups who are working for, you know, making Spanish a second language in the United States, to say that that the U.S. should be bilingual, Spanish English, just like now Canada is bilingual, French and English. But there's also another group that wants to pass a constitutional amendment to make English the official language of the United States. So there's a real controversy around that. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I know in urban areas, in major urban areas, there are a lot of things that are Spanish English. I know I did my internship for seminary out in Los Angeles, and there all the public signs and everything were already Spanish and English 20 years ago. I did my graduate work at the University of Chicago, and in Chicago, like if you ride the public transportation system, buses or the subway or everything, all of that stuff was Spanish English. So that there's a lot of places where that's already happening, and I think I don't see a reversal. I mean, kind of again, Spanish-speaking peoples are one of the fastest-growing groups in the U.S. So I think they're going to have to change that pretty soon.
On the other hand, when immigrants come into a country, they're usually very willing to learn the language of the country they come into, if the opportunity is there. So maybe we need to give more opportunity for that to happen. But, yeah. I mean, I still speak Danish and my wife, particularly. We still speak English too. And maybe those could still have two languages. So that we have one we all understand, and they have the private. We have our private language,
yeah. Well, I know, but again, there are some areas, you know, to say, what's the private language? Like, there are some areas of Los Angeles that are so Spanish.
That's just
that I mean, English is really the private language.
There's no incentive to learn.
You can do everything in Spanish.
I was in Los Angeles the spring before we came here in 91, on a Sunday afternoon. And I came from Long Beach with a tram or whatever they call it. Walked in there on Broadway, and it took me a little while to realize that one reason I could enjoy myself so much and see so much was that I could look out over everybody, even when they had the hammer. Because they were all Hispanic people, and I was the one who was different. That was a different experience.
Yeah.
And I guess it would be the same if I went to Guatemala and Nicaragua. So I'd really stick out.
But you're right, there are some places in the States that it almost is like going down to Central America, because it is so heavily populated with those groups. In Guatemala they gave us this statistic that said that 1/3 of the economy in Guatemala, the gross domestic product, comes from people in the U.S. sending money down to family and relatives in Guatemala.
Well, the Mexican laborers I work with, they bought money orders at the post office and sent them to their relatives in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the thing like this rumor business in Guatemala that Americans would steal children, is the church somehow involved with trying to quell that kind of rumor?
Yeah, from what I know about that, it didn't seem like the church was directly involved in that one way or the other. That certainly the church wasn't involved in spreading the rumor.
No, I mean, but the church would be involved, I was always thinking, the truth telling.
In the truth, yeah, right. And in saying it's not true. And yeah, there are certain, you know, pastors, ministers that say that. But again, you know, the way that spreads, right? I mean, kind of from person to person and everything, it's so hard to stop. And now even again, right, like in the papers, right, there are official word in the papers that, you know, the president says it's a rumor, the minister of defense. But, you know, people are very suspicious. Again, once that kind of thing starts, it's very hard to stop. And, talking with people, again, in the church, they would say it's a rumor, but they didn't have any specific campaign or anything like that against it. I mean, they're involved in so many other things, and they're really interested in this, in the peace process and in the resettlement of refugees and displaced persons from the last 10 years of war,
right,
that they just haven't taken this up as one of their key projects. I guess there's, you know, only so many things you can do, and they just don't have enough people, energy, money, whatever it takes to have that as a campaign. Yeah, the church in Guatemala right now is particularly working again with the resettlement of refugees, because there's about 1.5 million refugees that over the last 10 years left Guatemala and moved to Mexico.
Yes.
And now they want to come back. And so it's you know, with a country that has a population of about 5 million people, I mean, so 1.5 million, that's, you know, when that's 20% of your population, let's say, left. Now, how are you going to get 20% of your population back, settle them where they want? I mean, basically, right, they were driven off their lands. Those lands, either other people have been squatting on it, or somebody took it over and now says it's my land, right, and then got a legal title to it and everything. These people come back in and say, well, we were chased off our land by the military. We want our land back. Now, how do you settle that? I mean, that's the major dispute in Guatemala right now, and that's the area where the church is most involved in trying to get these refugees back who want to come back and settle the land claims and land disputes, either, you know, making trades or setting up cooperatives or getting money to buy land back from people to give to these people and all of those kinds of things. That's the primary area where the churches are working at, both at all levels, from World Council of Churches and Lutheran World Federation and Catholic Human Rights Commission, Catholic Social Services, and then all the different local congregations and churches. They're all working together. And the UN. It's interesting that on this one, the World Council of Churches, and the United Nations High Commission on Refugees is working cooperatively on resettling. Because the UN recognizes that, at least in Guatemala, the churches are as important and influential in doing this as they are, and they know as much about it. So they're really relying on church leadership to kind of set up these peace commissions and land grievance commissions.
It's full of problems.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, it'll take a long time to resolve. In the past 10 years, they literally wiped out 440 villages in Guatemala. The military would just go in, round up what they thought or who they thought were the leaders in the community, often take them to the church in the community, and then they'd bomb the church and set it on fire. That's how they get rid of the leaders. Then the rest of the people would scatter, and then they would come in and burn down the village, bring in a bulldozer, what was left, raise the village, just level it. And so the people, you know, fled for their lives. And so now, right, they're coming back. And they want their village back, right? They want help building their villages. They want to settle back in these places again. Right. But usually what happened is somebody within the military, a colonel, a general, or whatever, said since the land was abandoned, they took it over and got a legal deed, a property title, to say, well, now this is my land. So that's the issue. How do we give that land back? And that's a long way to go. Yeah.
You can create something there that won't heal forever, like the situation in the former Yugoslavia, where they also had one wave of people coming in,
yeah,
and pushing you out, and then another one, and then push back. And who belongs there?
Yeah. Well, that's been the issue in Guatemala for 40 years now. In 1954, they elected a person by the name of Arbenz to be president of Guatemala. And one of his key things was land reform. And that's back when United Fruit Company, the U.S. big banana company, right, owned a lot of that land, and Arbenz was going to nationalize that land and distribute it among the poor peasant farmers. Well, Eisenhower was president of that, and the U.S. thought that was against their best interests and their security, and through the CIA, they led a coup against Arbenz, overthrew his government, killed him. And that's when they set up the military government and, you know, took over all the land and that stuff. And that's kind of what has started all of this. And we're still living with those consequences today. So that for over 40 years in Guatemala, the issue has been land reform. And it still hasn't happened. And most people say there won't be peace in that nation until there is a more just and equitable distribution of the land. Right? Until that happens, there won't be peace. Because again, like you said, I mean, for the indigenous peoples of Guatemala, the Mayan peoples, and they've been living on that land for centuries. Now, you can't tell them, oh, I'm sorry, United Fruit Company owns this land, or, you know, General so-and-so owns. I mean, they don't believe it. Right? I mean, they can tell their stories that take them back before the conquest by the Spanish. And, you know, so they know that land is theirs. And so until something happens that they feel that they've gotten justice, there won't be peace.
Well, we need a whole world need to work out the question of Jubilee.
Yeah.
An evening out of all the accounts. Everyone starts on the same footing every so often, so it doesn't pay to be get greedy.
Well, again, in Guatemala with the Mayan folk, it's very interesting. I mean, the whole notion of a person owning the land is totally foreign to them. Even for them, even the communities didn't own the land. It was the sense that kind of the gods had given them the land, and they were kind of the renters or the caretakers of it.
Well, they got a better concept of
Much better concept.
Than the Jewish Christian tradition.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, for them again, it's almost sacrilegious to think that a person could own the land and say that land is mine. To think, no, right? That the earth is sacred and that it is a gift, and it's a gift that that God gives us. And so, they are to cherish that gift. But you can't own it. I mean, for them, that would be one of the worst offenses you could do. So that even with that, again, you can see how that's going to lead to all the different conflicts, because they...
Yeah, even if you give them a piece of land, then they would feel like they committed a crime.
Right. Right, so that it's they want their ancestral lands, but
yes.
but they're not interested in, you know, again, legal property rights and titles and those kind, because it just doesn't make any sense to them. I mean, they basically want to live where their God said, this is your gift, so this is where you should be, right? I mean, again, for them, living on a particular piece of land is really carrying out faithful, sacred living. I mean, there's that religious dimension to it, which again, legally and from the position, I guess, of Western ways of looking at things, we just don't understand very well. Or if we are beginning to understand it, we're certainly not helping them live that out. And you're right, I mean, probably the closest thing that within the Judeo-Christian tradition comes to that is the notion of Jubilee, where we recognize that it's really God who gives us the land, and that we need to, every now and then, level that out again. Yeah, no, these indigenous peoples have a much better sense of that than we do.